I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, author Akash Kapoor reflects on growing up in the utopian Indian community of Oroville and why these intentional communities are still deeply embedded in his psyche.
If you've inhabited the idea of perfection and the dream of a better world when you were a kid, you can grow up and you can recognize the fallibility of that idea, and you can recognize why it's perhaps not feasible, but there's a part of your brain and your dreams and your imagination that still clings to it.
But Kapoor is clear that noble intentions have the habit of bumping up against the realities of human nature.
You can see how idealism quickly becomes extremism and becomes fanaticism, and can become very cruel, can become very intolerant of humanity and human difference. And I feel like Orville went through that, and I lived through some of that as a kid.
The freedoms, complexities, and darker realities of utopian societies, all ahead on Life Examined. The idea of utopian societies is not a modern invention. The word utopia was first coined in 1517 by Sir Thomas More. At the time, More's vision for the perfect society was more puritanical than the free-love hippie communes of the 60s and 70s. But the ideal is the same: a rejection of the established state and an embrace of more egalitarian forms of society. History, of course, is rife with examples of people who've tried to create fairer societies. Perhaps no bigger example would be the former Soviet Union, conceived as a rejection of class, money, and state, while promising equal rights and opportunities to all. For better or for worse, these types of utopian systems, albeit on a smaller scale, continue to exist. Communes, monasteries, ashrams, and intentional communities, they all embrace community, simplicity, and again, egalitarian values. But what happens in these communities when the individual is sacrificed at the altar for the greater ideal? What happens when noble intentions collide with the complexities and differences in human nature? Akash Kapoor was born in the utopian community of Oroville, India, and spent his formative years there before moving to the U.S. at the age of 16. He would later go on to Harvard. In his latest book called Better to Have Gone, Love, Death, and the Quest for Utopia in Oroville, he shares his unique perspective on life in utopia, both the ideals and the darker realities of the place he continues to call home. Well, Akash Kapoor, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on for the full hour of Life Examined.
Thank you so much.
I want to discuss this idea of utopian or intentional communities. There's a line I heard you say, I think it was in another interview. You said, quote, "Big themes of history and the impulses of humankind often play out in small communities." I love that line. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about it and why it kind of captures the essence of some of these places.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, so this was something that I thought about a lot as I was writing the book, because I was writing a story set in one specific community in South India. And like many of these communities, it's not a huge community. You know, it has about 3,000 people. And I was trying to think, like, what is the relevance of what goes on here to the broader world? And as I was researching, I don't think I'd started the writing yet, I came across this quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, where he describes Brook Farm, which was a 19th century intentional community in Massachusetts. He describes it as, quote, "a French revolution in small, an age of reason in a patty pan." And it struck me that, yes, like in these communities, you have their sort of condensations of humanity, and you have all these idealistic impulses and all these sort of these urges to create a better world for better and for worse, the noble and the dark side of that impulse playing out. And in some ways, it's even more intense because the places are so small, and so it's also condensed.
And so besides the fact that you grew up in this place, have you had a lifelong interest in these places and in looking at other ones around Oroville? How does your interest extend beyond it?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been interested in intentional communities all my life. But beyond intentional communities, I've been interested in sort of some of the broader themes that come out of here. So sort of planning and human nature and how it interacts for better and for worse against plans. Because, you know, utopian communities are often tightly regimented, planned places, and then they sort of run up against the complexity of human nature.
Right.
So I've been interested not only in intentional communities, but I was very interested in, for example, the former Soviet bloc, you know, Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, And I spent some time after college in Poland and in Romania and in places like that, because again, it was happening at a much larger scale. But I think that many of the things that we saw play out there, for better and for worse, were things that you often see playing out in these small communities. And I remember there was this moment once when I was, I must have been about 22, 23, and I was sitting in a coffee shop in Krakow, in Poland. It must have been my second week, maybe third week in Eastern Europe, and I'm sitting in a coffee shop and I'm reading this book called The Captive Mind. I don't know if you know this book. Mm-mm. It's by Czesław Miłosz, who is a Polish poet.
Great poet, but also, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, but also a great Polish intellectual. And he wrote this book called The Captive Mind, which was a kind of study in belief and ideology and how so many intellectuals and his sort of contemporaries got caught up in the communist system. And I'm reading this book in this coffee shop and I'm thinking, oh, I know this story. I've lived this story. You know, I grew up in a small intentional community in South India, but I've seen all this stuff play out there.
I love the fact that you can bring, say, communist countries or communities into this, because these are all different ways of thinking. How do we build a better world? How do we build better lives? What are the systems we put in place? Just like you said. And mm-hmm. and before we talk about the specifics of Oroville, I wonder for you, do you see any unifying principles or underlying philosophies of different intentional communities or different kind of experimental governmental systems? What would you say? Is there anything?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, they all begin with rejection. That's the easy part, right? Yeah. We reject the world as it is. As I said, that's the easy part. Then you've got to figure out what you're going to build and what you're going to make. It's hard because, you know, they are different. I think they're culturally determined. I think they're very much determined by the age in which they appear to. Some people have written of saying that utopia works best as a critique of the current system. And so then, you know, by its nature, it sort of reflects what's going on in the world at the time. I would say if we were to look for broad principles, you see things like egalitarianism, especially material egalitarianism, economic egalitarianism. They often do have a spiritual or religious component to them. I think that's partly in reaction to the sort of materialism of the world. And then the other domain that I see that cuts across a lot of these things is the family or sex or intersexual relations, because there's often an attempt to recreate the family unit and rethink traditional families and sexual relations.
Interesting. Well, let's try and frame ourselves now in this incredible area of India and Oroville. And I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about Sri Aurobindo. Who was he and what's the role that he plays in creating this place?
Mm-hmm. So Sri Aurobindo, he starts off, well, he goes to Cambridge when he's very young. He's sort of an upper-class Indian who's educated in Cambridge, quite brilliant. He performs brilliantly in Cambridge. And then he comes back to India and he becomes a freedom fighter, actually. So he's trained by the British system, but like many people, you know, Nehru was another one of them. They come back and partly because of their training, they realize the sort of injustices of colonialism. So he becomes a freedom fighter and he's involved in some pretty high profile actions against the British. And it's partly for this reason, because then he's on the run from the British because they're after him, that he makes his way south to this town called Pondicherry in South India, which at the time was a French colony. Mm. And so this is actually his way of escaping the arm of the British, basically. And he gets there. And then when he's there, he starts going deeper into ancient Indian thought. So he's trained in a very modern way. He's a modern intellectual, but he's always had an interest in spirituality. And he goes deeper and deeper into spirituality and spiritualism when he is in Pondicherry. He writes voluminous books. I mean, he's written a lot and it's very learned and his vocabulary is copious. And these books, he's basically trying to sort of recreate or almost invent a new system of yoga based on traditional yoga. And he calls this the integral yoga. This integral yoga eventually becomes the philosophical underpinning for Oroville.
Can you say a little bit more about integral yoga? How does it work? What are some of the ideas?
Sure. So I think one of the main starting points of integral yoga is that it is based on ancient traditional Indian philosophy and spiritual teachings, but it's an attempt to kind of rework them and modernize them and rethink them.
Mm.
And I guess, I mean, it's got quite a few strands, but I guess I would highlight two strands in particular. One is that, you know, traditional Indian yogic practices had often been based on asceticism and a kind of retreat from the world and a rejection of the world. And so Sri Aurobindo rejects that. And he has this famous saying where he says, it's an aphorism basically at this point, where he says, all life is yoga.
Mm.
And it's an attempt to infuse material living and everyday living, whether you're building a house or whether you're just, you know, building a business, but to infuse it with a kind of spiritual integrity and faith. That's one key component of integral yoga. The second one is this kind of evolutionary strand. He is convinced that the state at which man is now is not its final state, that evolution will continue, and moreover, that this evolution can kind of be willed through spiritual practice and through yogic practice. So in some ways, I sometimes compare it to, it's kind of a Nietzschean thought, the sort of like will to a higher being, mm. except it's very infused with Indian spirituality and traditional Indian yoga.
The idea, though, is that man would become a more perfect being or a more spiritual being, something like that, I suppose.
Yeah, more perfect, more spiritual, more in touch with the divine in a secular sense. Mm. So in a word, yeah, more spiritual.
How do these ideas then become the building blocks of Auroville?
Right, so Sri Aurobindo is living in Pondicherry, and eventually a woman whose original name is Mira Alfasa, a French woman, makes her way to Pondicherry. She arrives around the First World War, and she ends up staying there and building this spiritual community known as the Sri Aurobindo Ashram with Sri Aurobindo in Pondicherry. Sri Aurobindo passes away in 1950, and then the mother takes over the administration of the ashram, mm. and she's long had notions of a kind of ideal city or ideal society, and she eventually conceives of Auroville as this place that will be a laboratory for Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, so a laboratory for the integral yoga. And so she conceives of Auroville, and then it's founded in 1968, by the mother. She is technically the founder, but the idea is that it's founded on the philosophy of Sri Aurobindo.
Wow. So what was life intended to look like at Auroville? What were there daily rituals? Were there farming systems, group prayer? What was it supposed to be like? And then I know you grew up here, so we can kind of talk about perhaps what it was like.
So one of the interesting things about Auroville is that, and one of the reasons it survived, is that Mira Alfasa, who later became known as the mother and who was this founder and the leader of Auroville, she was quite loose in her guidelines. Mm. And so they weren't very, you know, they weren't, like you asked, were there specific rituals? No, they weren't really specific rituals or specific things that one was supposed to do. And I think that over time, actually, that looseness and that lack of specificity is one of the reasons the community survived, because it wasn't actually overly ritualized or overly dogmatic. But broadly, you know, life in Auroville was people who were coming to Auroville were supposed to be interested in the integral yoga, was supposed to be practicing some version of the integral yoga, and it was sort of left up to individuals to decide what that meant. There was an emphasis on communal living, which means shared ownership of property. There was no, and there remains no private real estate ownership within the confines of the community. Egalitarianism, the spiritual aspect of the community was manifested in several ways, but I guess one of the most important ways is that there was going to be, and it was eventually built, this big secular meditation space built at the heart of Auroville, mm. which became known as the Matri Mandir. And so a lot of early life in Auroville actually revolves around building this building, and that in some ways is the most physical manifestation of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy and the mother's ideals.
Mm. I take it also very, as you said, with shared property, very egalitarian principles. Was there any sense of order or leadership or hierarchy?
Well, early on, the mother is the leader. And mm. so one of the interesting things is that the mother is always situated in Pondicherry, and she never actually sets foot in Auroville, partly because her health is frail. Mm. But she is the leader, and you know, every decision, it's sort of fascinating when you go through the archives, every decision, no matter how big or how small, so down to sort of selecting the location of a bore well or naming a child, goes to her. But she, the mother, passes away pretty early. She passes away in November of 1973, which is, you know, 5.5 years or so after Oroville is formed. So pretty early in the community's history, it's left without a leader. And at that point, yeah, there's jockeying for authority. There's jockeying for power, which ends up being, you know, quite harmful to the community in its early history.
So talk to me about how you would end up growing up there. Your parents would eventually make it to Oroville. I know we could spend a lot of time on this, but I wonder if you could give us a snapshot of what brought your life there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it begins with my grandfather, who is a Hindu living in Pakistan around the time of partition. Like many Hindus at the time, he's forced to migrate to India. They lose everything in the process. A lot of members of his family are killed, and he's sort of left kind of bereft by that. And I guess that probably precipitates a turn towards spirituality. He makes his way down south eventually to the ashram being run by Sri Aurobindo and the mother. And so that's how my family ends up sort of being settled there. My father grows up there, and then he's one of the first generation of Indians that actually goes to America for an education. Where he meets my mother at an anti-war rally, an anti-Vietnam War rally in Denver. You know, it's the 1960s and anything seems possible. And the next thing you know, my mother, who's from a small town in Minnesota and has never been out of the United States, and the next thing you know, they're taking this big overland trip. And then they're in Port Sudan and they take a ship to India. And then they're living in this, you know, hut by the edge of a field in South India, building a new world.
Wow. Would you say that they were seekers, they were spiritual seekers, to put themselves in that kind of a situation?
Definitely. They were definitely seekers. And then the spiritual seeker part, I think, is a little more complicated because I think you have many strands in a place like Oroville. Some people come there explicitly for the spiritual purpose and the spiritual goals. Some people are more generally enthused by the idea of a new world, a better society, a better world. I think most people who end up there are seekers or searchers, or as I refer to them in my book, dreamers. Maybe they each have different dreams, you know, and they play those dreams out very differently.
So, were you born there?
I was not. I was actually born somewhere else in India, where my father happened to be doing his PhD research. But I moved there, so we moved back there. We went back and forth a lot, but I moved back there when I was, I guess, probably a year and a half or something.
Can you talk about some of your earliest memories of Oroville and just what life was like there, what you remember, what it sounded like, tasted like, felt like? Would love some descriptions.
Sure. I mean, what I remember most is the openness of the land. That's a very, very vivid memory, because Oroville was formed on this desert terrain, this sort of barren plateau where there really wasn't much there. And so that sense of openness, while it was physical and geographical, I think it was also very psychological, especially for the adults in the world, because it really felt like a perfect sort of physical setting for a new world. So I remember that. I remember a sense of community. I mean, even when you're a kid, you have a sense of, you know, sharing a world. Meals are often eaten together in a communal kitchen, and I have vague memories of that. And people are just, like, many adults are part of your life beyond just being neighbors. I mean, they're sort of extended family in a way. And then over time, those memories change, because one of the things Oroville did, and I think one of its most remarkable achievements, is that it forested that land, and it did this amazing work in ecological restoration. And so I start having memories of saplings that turn into little trees and then eventually turn into big trees coming up on the land, and this feeling of kind of growing up along with the forest, which now towers over me, of course.
Yeah, that's a lovely image. Simple question, but I mean, electricity, plumbing, basic things like that, did they exist there?
Early on, they didn't exist.
Yeah.
And so early on, life is pretty hard. Some of the first people who settle the land are, you know, they're roughing it. They're definitely camping out there. So no electricity, no running water. There's generally a community would have a kind of a shared well, bore well, and you would go there with buckets and you would fill your water up. Your house would be lit with, you know, kerosene oil lamps, and gradually, no telephones, obviously. Gradually, over time, things get a little more comfortable. You start having a little more running water and then electricity. And then, I remember when the telephones start coming in, that was a big deal. That was sometime in the mid-80s, probably. We started getting telephones in the community.
Mm. Do you remember this as a happy place?
Yeah, I remember having a very happy childhood because life is very free. Life is very open and unstructured, for better or for worse.
Sure, sure.
But when you're a kid, you love that, and you have a lot of close friends, and it's safe, and you're roaming the land. And I guess somewhere, even though you don't know too specifically or explicitly what's going on, somewhere you have a sense of being in a world that's trying to do something special, or a world that's different and that's trying to build something different. And this, you sort of absorb that sensation by osmosis, even if you don't specifically know what's going on.
Yeah. What about education? How did you learn? How did you become a student?
Yeah. So education, I write about this in the book, education was a complicated thing. I mean, the mother in Pondicherry had schools, and they were well run, and they were sort of, quite tightly run schools. In Orville initially had that. But one thing that happens after the mother's passing is the community goes through a period of kind of extremism and fundamentalism, where this desire to reject the world grows in intensity. Mm. And one of the more unfortunate consequences of that is that a sort of a group of Orovillians, decided that we don't need traditional education anymore, that this is all the old world. And so the schools were shut down. There was a lot of those kids who did receive an education received an informal education in a way, like they were homeschooled by a few adults who were still willing to educate kids and who saw the importance of it. And I went through that for a certain period of time. And then at a point, my parents, I guess, seeing what was going on, we actually moved from Orville to Pondicherry, where the schools were still happening, and I got a more structured education. And then we moved back to Orville when I was a little older, when the flames of extremism had kind of burnt out.
Mm, interesting. I mean, I should let our listeners know you would go on to Harvard and have led a very successful life as an intellectual. So one way or another, you were prepared to kind of enter more traditional scholastic environments, right?
Yeah. And many of my peers also went on to colleges in the real world, as we called it. I mean, one of the things I always felt when I was at Harvard, I mean, I felt that I was less smart than many of my peers, for sure. I was less well-trained than many of my peers. But the one thing I think that Orville had given me was the ability to think differently and the ability to think out of the box. And I suppose that probably helped me in my academic life in the real world.
Mm. How did Orville transform or not throughout the years? You mentioned there were pockets of kind of more extreme or periods of more extreme thought. What would you say it kind of was becoming over the years?
Yeah, I mean, it's gone through a few different phases. So after the mother, its founder, passes away, there's this sort of vacuum in the community. And as often happens in these moments of vacuum, extremism steps into it. I mean, you see this in throughout history. You see this in religions too. And so there was this kind of extremist movement in the community that was pretty unfortunate. And I really feel, many communities actually collapse after the passing away of their founder because of this vacuum. And I do feel that Orville maybe stepped to the edge of the precipice, but managed to pull back, and then sometime around the mid-80s started emerging from it, and it emerged into a more settled, less intense, and in a way less idealistic world. So some people bemoan the loss of that idealistic fire, which had its positive sides but also had its very negative sides. And over time, I mean, I say in the book, I say that communities are like humans. They have life cycles, and I suppose those idealistic years were Orville's teenage years, when you know everything and right from wrong, and over time it grows a little older, a little wiser. Now it's 53, 54 years old, so it's a little bit more middle-aged in a way, which means some people bemoan the loss of idealism, but I think on balance I'm happier to have idealism that's a little tempered by reality, and it's a little more tolerant than the sort of raging idealism that the community had in the 70s and 80s.
Why would you say that? What in a sense makes you appreciate the more tempered side of that argument?
Well, I mean, I think idealism, like faith, it sort of exists on a spectrum. And it has its very noble side, and it has its very dangerous side. And I feel that growing up in an intentional community like Auroville, and I've talked to other people who have lived through these things, you come to appreciate some of the more moderate sides of idealism because you've lived through and you've seen some of the more dangerous sides of idealism, and you can see how idealism quickly becomes extremism and becomes fanaticism, and can become very cruel, can become very intolerant of humanity and human difference. And I feel like Auroville went through that. And I lived through some of that as a kid. And I've always felt that was unfortunate. And I've always felt that it was a very cruel period. And so I do believe in idealism. I do believe in the urge and the will to create a better world and to reinvent the world and not just accepting the status quo. But I am not a huge fan of dramatic, disruptive, radical change, because I see not only in Orville, but I see throughout history. I mean, look at the French Revolution. Look at revolutions throughout history. Look how badly that goes so often.
Mm. Can you give me an example at Auroville where you felt that things had gone too far, just so we can kind of get a sense of what this could mean in a community?
Yeah, absolutely. The fact that the schools were shut down in the mid to late 70s is a very good example of idealism being taken too far, because the idea was, look, we're here in Auroville to recreate a new world. We're not here to just do it the way that we've done it elsewhere. And you know, education is a sort of like purveyor of existing status, and it helps regenerate existing hierarchies and old forms of knowledge. And so we're just going to do away with traditional education. Now, I can understand that impulse. I mean, I share the impulse to create a better system of education and to create a better world. But the fact that that led to the schools being shut down and to a generation of kids being denied a formal education at formative years was terrible. And many of the people who went through that are still bearing the scars of those years.
Interesting. What about were there any kind of compulsory actions that anyone needed to take there? Any very tight rules at periods? Or, I mean, you reflected on the fact that it was also fairly vague and open, too. I wonder if there's anything you would add about that.
Yeah, I mean, there really aren't. I mean, I've thought about this. Is there anything that one has to do? And the answer is, I can't really think of anything. One of the things, you know, that happened when there was this extremist moment is that you had a faction of Aurovillians that probably would have liked there to be more of that regimented life and probably did have certain rules that they would have imposed on people. But generally speaking, Auroville has lived by the rules of what some of us sardonically call divine anarchy, which, you know, at its worst means it barely holds together and it's hard to get anything done. But at its best means that it's been able to grow organically and tolerate difference and different systems of belief and different forms of the yoga. And I really believe that this is one of the reasons that Auroville still exists, because it was able to accommodate that difference. Because, again, I mean, throughout history, you look at these intentional communities and they often fall apart because they're too rigid and because they can't encompass the complexity and the many differences of human nature.
Mm. I think it's also important for some of our listeners to note, and this is just an important use of the word and how popular it is, that when we think of a life dedicated to yoga, I mean, we're not literally talking about people probably doing Western style yoga all the time, but this is a much different kind of spiritual philosophy, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And my publishers made me add a footnote about that to the U.S. edition, which, by the way, is not in the Indian edition, because I think it's more understood there. But yes, we're talking about, it's more a kind of ethical discipline, a system of life, a system of self-cultivation, not dissimilar maybe to the way, you know, the ancient Greeks believed in self-cultivation and self-perfection.
Were there any interesting examples of food systems there, of growing your own food or of diets or anything like that?
Well, agriculture was a big deal because people were living on this denuded plateau and they had to figure out an economy that was at least to some extent self-sustaining, because they were trying to reject conventional economy and conventional money. So agriculture was a big deal, and there was a lot of early cultivation of the land, which I should say was often done in partnership with the local Tamil population. I mean, the early Aurovillians learned a lot from farmers who had traditionally inhabited the area. And so there was a lot of millet and rice and all kinds of vegetables planted there. In terms of diets, no community-wide thing. I mean, certainly Orville attracts the kinds of people that, you know, experiment with diets. And so some of the people I wrote about were very into macrobiotics, for example. But that was a very personal choice. I mean, it was just because those types of people were, you know, generally attracted to Orville.
Akash Kapoor is the author of Better to Have Gone, Love, Death, and the Quest for Utopia on Orville. And he'll join us for part two of the conversation after this short break. And while I have you, here on Life Examined, we have a goal this summer of getting to 100 ratings and 50 reviews on Apple Podcasts. So if you're a fan and want to help us grow the show, please take a minute and write a few words. It goes a long way. And if it makes any difference, I read every one of the comments and love seeing what you all have to say.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We'll now continue my conversation with Akash Kapoor. He was born and raised in Auroville, a utopian community in India, inspired by the philosophy and yoga of a sage named Sri Aurobindo. Kapoor's father is Indian, and his mother comes from a small town in Minnesota. Kapoor moved to the U.S. at 16, where he attended a prestigious boarding school and later Harvard. His book, Better to Have Gone, Love, Death, and the Quest for Utopia in Auroville, examines the unconventional community where he and his wife, Auralise Graft, grew up, and traces the history of Graft's mother and stepfather and their mysterious death. Without giving too much away here, writing and researching the book together was at times revelatory and at other times difficult, but in the end, the book shines a light on the darker corners of Graft's life and those of her parents. We'll jump back into my conversation now and hear more about Kapoor's wife and who her mother and stepfather were.
Yeah, so my wife has a somewhat complicated family history, and she grew up, like many kids in Orville, in a kind of extended family. I mean, we were often told that the community was our family. So she had a biological father, an American man named Larry, who is still alive and very much part of our lives. And she spent many years with her mother, who was a Belgian woman named Diane, and an American man who was married to her mother named John Walker, who was her stepfather. And the book is in many ways about Diane and John Walker, her stepfather, who had a very difficult life in Orville. I mean, without giving away too much of the plot, Diane suffered a terrible accident in the late 70s. This accident became part of a kind of emerging mythology in Orville. And to cut ahead, eventually, 10 years later, her stepfather and her mother, with whom she was living, both died in very tragic and somewhat mysterious circumstances on the same day.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, do you think this highlights the more human, complex, and sometimes dark side of these communities?
Yes, absolutely. I think that what happened to my wife's mother and adoptive father, Diane and John, is a very good illustration of how idealism can begin very nobly and can just tip over the edge into a terrible, tragic, extremist place. Because, you know, early on in the book, as I was reconstituting their lives, they come to Orville with so much idealism and so much kind of faith, and it's so noble and it's so beautiful. And they carry that very same impulse. I mean, it's a continuity, and there's a continuum there. They just carry it over the edge. They believe too far. They believe too much. They deny themselves medical care because they're so into the yoga and they have so much faith in the spiritual aspect of their lives that they end up dying very unnecessarily and very tragically. And I think it's a very good illustration of how things that are noble and begin in a very good place can end in a very dark place.
This to me kind of raises, I think, one of the big questions about why some of these communities work, some of them don't. And to me, it begs a question about human nature. What, you know, what is in us that make these communities both tenable and also destructive at the same time? What are the human impulses in us that are at play here? I wonder if something you've thought about when you were writing this.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot. I mean, and I think human nature and utopia are to some extent irreconcilable, and they keep bumping up against each other. And one of the reasons is that human nature is complex. It has multiple variables. It's not easy to summarize. It's certainly not easy to regiment or to control. And utopias, which are often planned societies, by definition are planned and you know, simplify that complexity of human nature. And another way of putting it is just that so often in these communities, human beings and individuals are sacrificed at the altar of ideals, right? Mm-hmm. And it just feels, it's like, you know, human beings are collateral damage on the way to achieving this great goal. But, you know, what is a community if it's not the individuals that make it up? And I think that when these communities tip over into quote unquote idealism or ideals that are willing to sacrifice human beings, whether it's literally sacrificing them by executing them as many utopias have done over time, or just by terrible cruelty, they lose their humanity. And gradually, when you lose your humanity, the community falls apart.
Mm. Let me pose this, and maybe it's too reductive, but I wonder if it resonates at all. I mean, the idea of a utopian community in which you give everything to it, right? So mm-hmm. this is this notion of utter selflessness, which I wonder if that runs counter to true human nature, which frankly might be a little selfish, right? I mean, can people truly give everything up and have that be a sustainable life? What do you think?
I agree with the premise of your question that it's very, very difficult. Human beings, I believe, are inherently selfish, gene-propagating, profit-seeking. That is human nature. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to, you know, tip into that absolute extremes of that, and those can be tempered, and certainly some of us are more idealistic than others. But any system that tries to eliminate that and overlook that is running up against human nature. You know, a man once told me something in Oroville when I was a kid, and I didn't fit this in the book, but it's really interesting, and it's something that I've thought about a lot. He said, Oroville worked just fine. Everything was working fine in Oroville until people started having families and kids. Mm-hmm. Because people were willing to give up things for themselves, for the community. But when they start having families and kids, you know, then they start looking after their families, and they start putting their kids or their genes above the community. Yeah. And while I sort of disagree with the premise of the man's question or the man's statement, because I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, I think he's probably right that aspect of human nature is sort of, you know, contra to the utopian impulse.
Isn't that interesting? So there is something deeply biologic about us, or biological, or as just as you said, that will, no matter what, will pull at our offspring and care for them above anything else. I don't know. It's kind of a fascinating idea, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think that that's why a lot of these communities over time, I have a little riff, a very short riff on this in the book. A lot of these communities over time, one of their core premises is kind of remolding or reinventing human nature, right? It's not just like creating a new economy or a new system of education or, you know, more egalitarian societies. It's actually changing human nature, because I think human nature, for better or for worse, you know, runs up against these kinds of utopian impulses. So, you know, there's this famous quote by the philosopher Kant that was later taken up by Isaiah Berlin, where he says, "Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made."
Hmm.
And it's such a famous quote that it's almost become a little cliche. But I think that is at the core of the problem that many of these utopian societies face. That human nature is bent and it's crooked, and it's very hard to straighten it out and perfect it, basically.
Yeah. And I'm glad we're on this subject of kids, because, you know, what I've seen reading about these communities, or reading about really more extreme cult-like versions, are that kids can oftentimes be very hurt by these communities, whether neglected or forced to lead these very rigid lives they didn't ask for. I wonder if that's something you saw in your research as well.
Yes, absolutely. And again, because Oroville was less homogenous and less sort of like, you know, unitary, it really varied on the family. So I would say it just depended in a way on one's parents and how much one's parents were doctrinaire. I think certainly some kids who were denied an education are still bearing the scars today, and they will tell you that, although many of them will also tell you that those were magical years in their lives, and they, you know, they may be very committed to Orville, but they also feel the hurt of those years. And then you have families like mine, where my parents were, they were idealists, but I also feel it was somewhat realistic. And, you know, when they saw that the schools were shut down, they moved me into a school. I do think that human beings are good at holding two opposing thoughts in their heads at the same time. And we can be idealistic and realistic at the same time. And that's one of the reasons utopia doesn't work, because utopian thought isn't very good at holding opposing thoughts at the same time, but human beings are.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. Well, you've decided to remain at Oroville. You've moved away, lived abroad, done many things, but when we're not in a global pandemic, you would call Oroville home and have kids, is that correct? Or
yes, absolutely, yeah? In the schools then.
So talk to me about your decision to remain in this community, to have kids in this community, and expand a little bit on that if you could.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I say somewhere in the book that you have explicit idealists and implicit idealists. And the explicit idealists are the ones who say they're moving to Oroville because they want to make a better world. And the implicit idealists are the ones, and I would categorize my wife and myself in this, who don't always know what they're doing and are sort of guided by intuition or impulse. So all of this is to say that when we were living in New York in late 2003, early 2004, we moved back to Oroville. I'm not sure we had any explicit plans in our minds, but looking back on it in retrospect, I think we were clearly drawn to something we had lived through as children, and this sort of urge to be part of an experiment to make a better world with all its warts. I mean, eyes wide open, but still drawn to that idealism. And I think that's one of the reasons we moved back. I say somewhere in the book, I say that children of utopian communities are like exiles. And a lot of people have kind of misunderstood that quote. But what's been interesting is I've had a couple of emails from people who've grown up in utopian communities who knew exactly what I was talking about. And what I'm saying is that if you've inhabited the idea of perfection and the dream of a better world when you're a kid, you can grow up and you can recognize the fallibility of that idea, and you can recognize why it's perhaps not feasible. But there's a part of your brain and your dreams and your imagination that still clings to it. That's still there, and it's really hard to eradicate, even if you want to, you know. And so I think that's one of the reasons we ended up back there.
That's really interesting. And as you were saying that, I was kind of imagining that the scenario in which even if just as you say, you're not living up to this idea of perfection, you feel like you're part of a community that's trying to advance something together. Your neighbor believes in something greater, and in a sense, these are the kind of the tendrils that keep you connected to people. I find that to kind of be a very rich idea.
Yeah, and that's why I like to call these places intentional communities rather than utopian communities, because intentional communities signify the intent, that there is an attempt to build a better world and to do something in a humble way where you know that you're not going to build a perfect world. Of course not. Perfection isn't attainable. But yeah. And another thing I say about utopian communities, it's very much a glass half full, half empty situation. And it's very easy to castigate these places. And believe me, I often do, for all their hypocrisies and all the ways they fail to live up to, you know, their stated ideals and goals. And that's the glass half empty. But you could also say, well, at least they're trying, and at least they've created the embers of something, and at least they've built something that's somewhat different and maybe even just a little bit better in some ways. And that's the glass half full.
Mm. I want our listeners to really kind of imagine this place. And so, for example, you've talked about these great memories of growing up there, but what might a normal day be like for someone at Oroville? And I realize there's a diversity of people there, but like, how could we imagine kind of waking up there and how you might go about a day?
Today? Like on
sure.
Contemporary?
Yeah.
Well, in some ways I would say a day in Oroville is very much like a day anywhere in the world. I get up, I feed my kids, I drive them to school, I put them in school, I go to a kind of co-op where I get my groceries. I work. I do my. I play tennis or I go for a jog. So the everyday kind of appearance of life is very normal and I think quite recognizable. There are underlying that, there are certain things that feel different. I mean, you're very close to people in the community. You have a sense of sort of cohesion, a sense of sharing things with your neighbors. While there are no regimented rituals, there are collective meditation spaces that I would describe as secular meditation spaces. And so I would go to those maybe 2 times, 3 times a week. I would meditate at home every day, but I would go to those meditation spaces 2 or 3 times a week and meditate in an unreligious way, just in a kind of collective secular meditative way.
Do you find that a place like Oroville is a good place to age? There's a community that's supportive and that can, I don't know, help someone as they grow older?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that sense of community means that as people age, they're not as isolated as they might be out in the real world. There are you know, old age care homes for when people need help and need to be put into a home. But even before that, there's just more interaction, more community. There's a kind of center of life. So, you know, you can go to some of these collective meditation spaces, be part of an activity, be surrounded by other people. I think that Oroville and places like Oroville are great places to be when you're very young or when you're old. When you're in your middle age, it's a little bit difficult when you're a bit older, because if you have, you're struggling with kind of ambition or maybe the desire to provide for your kids, and you know, struggling with wanting to know how much to sort of devote yourself to the community versus build in the world. And so places can get a little complicated for that age bracket.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned these spaces of meditation or yoga. I wonder, for you, having probably been exposed to different levels of religious fervor, do you find yourself drawn to any of the spiritual traditions offered, or how would you describe it yourself?
You know, that's been one of the big changes that has happened in me over the last few years, and because of this book. You know, when you write a book, you're not just researching and putting words down. When you're really committed to it, it's a process. And so I started the book off being quite skeptical of faith and spiritual belief, partly because of what I had seen as a kid, and I'd seen faith and spirituality taken to an extreme and to fanaticism. And so I was quite skeptical of it. But partly through researching this book and writing about the people and reading their diaries and letters and talking to people, I felt like I sort of became acquainted with the, maybe this sounds grandiose, but with what I would call the nobility of faith and the noble impulse of faith. And I think of faith again as a continuum. It exists on a spectrum from nobility to sort of fanaticism. And, you know, some of the most beautiful buildings in the world, some of the most beautiful architecture has resulted from faith and spirituality. And some of the most horrible wars have also resulted from religion. And so one of the changes that's happened in me is, I wouldn't say that I've found faith. I think that would be overstating it. But I've definitely found a new appreciation for it. And I've come to just understand it and admire it a lot more than I did when I started writing this book.
I'd love to just take that just a little bit further.
Sure.
In what ways do you think having some type of a faith or spiritual practice enhances your life?
I think one of the things that faith gives you, it gives you a stronger center in the world. The world is a very relative place, and it's very easy to be pulled in many directions. And, you know, to maintain a sort of core set of values and to know who you are and what you want out of life is very, very difficult. And I think faith or a meditative practice can give you that. And I feel very lucky to have had that, to have been taught that as part of my life from a kid, that when you're confused or when you don't know what's happening or you don't know how to handle life, go meditate. It's a great tool, if nothing else. I think faith clearly gives people a sense of community and connectedness. I'm a little bit more skeptical of that because I see faith and spiritual practice for me as a very private individual thing, but I see that it gives that to many other people.
Well, as we start to kind of wrap this up, were there any surprising or epiphany-like moments when you were doing research for this book that just jumped out at you, that you didn't expect, digging a little bit further into the past and all these different lives?
One of the things that I discovered or that I thought about while writing this book was the kind of universality of this impulse to create a better world. And one of the ways I found that was because my main character in the book grew up in this very privileged, rarefied world in America. His father was director of the National Art Gallery, very wealthy man, very conservative man. And he never, you know, he was very puzzled by what his son was doing in India. And I think he was very disappointed that his son renounced all this privilege and moved to India to create a better world on a barren plateau in some remote corner. But one of the things I found in their letters over time is that actually the father was very much a seeker too, in his own way. And particularly as he gets older, he starts understanding his son's quest more and more, and he starts opening up to his son. And there's these beautiful exchanges of letters, particularly from later in both their lives. And the title of the book, Better to Have Gone, actually comes from one letter that his father writes to his son. He's sitting in this fancy home in Florida, very wealthy man, surrounded by wealth and privilege. And he says to his son, he says, I'm so glad that you actually went on this pilgrimage. Better to have gone than not to have gone at all. I've just stayed here and I've never made that search for reality that you've made. And it just made me see that this father, who had seemed so much a creature of the establishment, was himself a seeker. And that this is something very human that we all have and that we all manifest in our own way, our own divergent ways in the world.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful story. And I'm curious, you having researched these lives, having lived the life, I think, of a dreamer or a seeker, if you came across somebody that said, I want to go live out in the wild, live in this community, experience this, is your suggestion better to have gone?
My suggestion is be careful. Do it, but be careful. I thought a lot about, while I was writing this book, there was a book that was in my mind a lot, Into the Wild by John Krakauer. Yeah. It's set in a completely different setting. It's one man, it's not a community, but it's the same thing. It's this originally noble, idealistic impulse that I at least can relate to and admire. But when it gets taken to an extreme, it's very dangerous. And so my advice to anybody that wants to renounce the ordinary world, wants to renounce family, wants to renounce the sort of safety of civilization is do it. It's great. I mean, you know, a lot of great things have come out of that throughout history, but be careful. Make sure you have rail guards, make sure you don't fall over the edge into fanaticism, extremism, or that you don't cause harm to yourself, because these things often end with people hurting themselves.
I've been speaking with Akash Kapoor. He's the author of Better to Have Gone, Love, Death, and the Quest for Utopia in Oroville. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation today. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Well, that's all for today. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. You can listen to this and all other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. There you'll see last week's episode on the science, purpose, and surprising health benefits of awe, which might have been one of my favorite episodes so far this year. You can also find us at kcrw.org/lifeexamined. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.